Hello, and welcome to the Pinoy Patriarch Project podcast. I am your host, Michael Pana. I am a Filipino-American husband, father of three boys, and full-time protector who's on the journey of learning what it means to be the leader of my home, my business, and my community. In this podcast, I speak to Filipino and Filipino-American leaders who exhibit strength, honor, and courage, who are leaders in their respective fields. In this episode, we sit down with my longtime teacher, kuya, and mentor, Tuan Carl Atienza of the Atienza Kali system, which is a Filipino martial art developed by the Atienza family as a means to deal with the multiple attacker scenarios and edge weapons attacks they experienced on the streets of Jamaica, Queens, in New York City. Tuan Carl is a highly respected martial artist. He is incredibly skilled and is highly respected by the most elite military operators and martial artists in the world. As a diehard martial artist throughout my life, I met Tuan Carl when I was 17 years old. Since then, he taught me not only how to become effective with a blade, but he has also guided me in all aspects of my life. He is the epitome of what it means to be a Pinoy patriarch. He not only is the leader of the Atienza Kali system, which is positively impacting hundreds upon thousands of people all over the world, but more importantly, he is also a devoted husband, brother, and son. In this interview, we discuss his rough upbringing, training in the martial arts as a means to deal with the regular violence occurring in his neighborhood growing up, as well as his relationship with his father, his Filipino-American identity, and his wife, Diane. It is my goal to show you not only one of the most respected warriors on the planet, but also one of the best human beings that I have the honor to know. I hope you enjoy. So yeah, thanks, Tuan, for coming out to the show. I know I've known you since I was about 17 years old. And so I want to make sure, you know, the first episode was with you because you're a massive influence in my life, not just as a martial artist, but as a man. And in this podcast, we're trying to show Filipino American men basically how to be better leaders, better fathers, better business owners, whatever. So before we continue into like discussing Atienza Kali and the martial art that you teach and that your family founded, as well as the blades that you make, which I definitely want to get into, I want to have the audience know who you are as a man. So if you could just talk about who you are, what you do, a little bit of your background, where you're from.
Okay. I mean, first of all, this is my first the first interview that I've done. I mean, we've done firesides. You know, I've been getting a lot of requests for like interviews, so I figured, you know, let's give the first one to guys in tribe first, you know, that way we can run a test run.
100%.
There's a bunch of things I can't say, so I just want to, you know, this is a good test run. Now, as far as myself, where do you want me to start?
Well, how about where you're from, your background, things like that, the basic stuff. Yeah.
I was born in Brooklyn, in New York, 1972, 51 now. Eventually, we moved out to Queens, went to school out there until like 1990, and then a neighborhood got real bad, so we had to get out. Did the whole college thing. Almost graduated with a degree in physics, minor mathematics, very close. Was into all that science and math. I was real good at that stuff when I was a kid. My grandfather was had a bunch of degrees, like two in engineering and two in law. Wow. Or something like that. So it was cool. I think I got some of that brain.
Yeah.
And then you know, went to college, did a lot of teaching since I was really young, and then eventually didn't want to be in corporate America anymore. Didn't want to be in the slave ship anymore. So contacted Pamana Tuan, and I have been doing this ever since I left my job. I think, when did you start? 03?
2002, yeah, 02.
02. So 03 is when I left my job, and that is all I've been doing since. So,
wow.
I mean, we can get into more of who I am as we talk, but you know,
100%
talking here for a while. Yeah.
So yeah, because like a lot, like I didn't know about that about your grandfather. That's pretty cool, you know. And like again, I've known you for so long, but there's so much I want to learn about you and your background and stuff like that. So speaking from your childhood, you know, as a Filipino American, and so what was that like? I mean, you spoke about this in the firesides, but what was that like growing, like from your childhood? What was one of the earliest memories that you can kind of discuss and kind of give you an insight into what it was like growing up Filipino American in that environment?
I mean, it's like any other, especially in the 70s, like culture. It's like, well, the culture is different from household to school is always different. You know, bringing in like Tupperwares full of rice and everybody's got peanut butter jelly sandwiches and Oreos and stuff. Yeah. Like just that kind of thing, like little cups of this inside it. And, you know, and then you get made fun of a little bit. And then eventually you start to learn about the culture. But yeah, there was a lot of that culture, because at the home, you know, like a lot of stuff is taught at home, the way you're taught to language, you know, and everything is very different, you know, especially the aggression. Like you'll see how aggressive a lot of the kids were. It doesn't matter what neighborhood it was. And then you learn that aggression eventually. And in general, when you're young Filipino, you're not the way you're raised, it's not the way, at least back then. And then the people that I knew back then, it wasn't the same. The Americans can be, I mean, we're all Americans now, but Americans, especially then, can be very, just the way they talk, can be very aggressive. And eventually you kind of learn that route, you know.
Sure. When you were growing up in that environment, you mentioned kind of like, you know, the identity of, you know, being, we're all American now, but back then there was a sense that you were different. Do you have any like stories and memories of that time having to deal possibly with racism or, you know, the struggles growing up as a kid?
Yeah. I mean, it was one of the main reasons for training back then. Like, I guess every minority deals with that when they come here, and then they learn to how to like conform to certain things. But I remember my dad telling me that he wanted to start a business when he was in the 70s or early 80s, where Filipinos wouldn't have accents, because when they would do the initial calls for jobs and they had an accent, they would never get called back. Because by the time, you know, you're Filipino and you talked a certain way, if your English was good, then you got to the job site for the second part of the interview or the first interview or whatever. And then they saw you were good, they would take you, because Filipinos are generally known for being good workers, right? But back then it wasn't, I remember he was saying that because they were losing opportunities for work just for the accents.
Right.
So it was part of the reason why he never taught us Tagalog, because he didn't want us having that. And that's different now, you know, it's pretty cool.
Right.
The way now Filipinos are, man, it's cool to talk Tagalog.
Yeah, right,
you
know, right.
You should, right? But our version of Tagalog wasn't the language. Our version of the culture was the martial arts.
Right.
So that's how we kept that. You know, we didn't carry buck knives, we carried balisongs, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So.
100%.
That kind of stuff coming up, you know.
Right. Because obviously I've known you for so long. The Filipino martial arts specifically, through your father, Pamana Tuhon, and everyone around you, is such a, it's like interwoven into your family culture. When you were a kid, what was your first training experience? I mean, growing up in an environment like that where training was not for recreation, but it really was a necessity. Is your first recollection of your father training you? How old were you when that happened?
I started training when I was four or five.
Right.
D was four, because D's like 2 years younger. Mm-hmm. But you know, like he catches up in a year, so like four or five.
Sure.
It wasn't. My dad was involved in some things, you know, so him and Pamana Tuhon, like when they were real young, so Pamana Tuhon probably a teenager, but dad's like his late 20s. I don't know if I should be talking about this. This is why I don't like doing these interviews, but you know, they're past now.
Right.
But they've seen some things on the street, lots and lots of things, you know, and my dad started to recognize that, you know, it's just like any family, they come here to a neighborhood that's a little cheap and, it's better than where he came from, because my dad grew up in the slums in the Philippines, like in Manila. So he said the slums here are not like the slums there. You know, it's rougher there. You know what I mean? He was like, it's like heaven here, but he saw the drugs coming in and he knew it was going to change up. So he wasn't training us for like, it was, you know, they usually train kids in martial arts confidence and self-esteem. He was like, no, you guys got to, you know, you're not joining gangs. You guys got to learn how to fight. So he had a lot of experience at that point for like street stuff. It's a lot of civilian stuff. If you're not law enforcement, military, it's always street work, right? So it was very militant, you know, to a point that we didn't like it. I remember not liking it when we were young. You know, like if we acted weak, go wash the dishes with your mom, you know, like he would do a lot of things, you know, like don't flinch, you know, like you put bugs on us and, you know, your kid, but put spiders on you. Don't be scared. Relax. You know I mean, like I learned, you know, if you just let him do it and just relax, he'll stop doing it. And, you know, I figured that out. Right now, that would be child abuse, I guess. But that's what makes you calm when someone's trying to put the blade to you and it just misses you. That's the training that is. And I was 5 years old. You know, me and my brothers are all like that. to a point by the time we were teenagers, we were very comfortable like guys trying to stab us. It was not anything, because most guys don't know what they're doing on the street anyway. You know what I mean? The hardest guy to get stabbed by was my dad. You know, but it was, everything was real. I remember everything wasn't, it was very militant, stand at attention, but, you know, push up.
Right.
You know, so I wouldn't recommend doing that now. I don't think that's necessary, but, you know, my dad was in his 20s, you know, like the 20s, man, you're rough in your 20s, especially
right.
where he came from and who he was hanging around with. So he was just trying to make his son strong for the neighborhood that he couldn't afford to get out of yet. And he was right. He was really right.
Right.
By the time we 12, 13, I saw people get stabbed, shot, and it kept us calm, that training. You know what I mean?
Right. 100%. That's really cool. So like when, I know you told me these stories before, and again, some of these are on the fireside. When you were a child, let's say around 8 years old, what was a common training session? You mentioned push-ups and stuff like that, but what was the, I guess the overall environment, like, was there kids outside of your family that were training? Was it all just the brothers training? Describe for me a day when you were like 8 or 9 years old, what that was like.
All right, first you'd have to find session. Us. Because yeah. every time it was time to train, we were running. We didn't because it was torturous. You know what I mean? There was a fun side to it towards the end, you know, but in the beginning, it was, you got hurt. And if you got, you know, you got hurt and you fixed things, you know, all right, you messed up this deflection. Do that again. You know, like, you know, there's a lot of crying. Stop crying. What's the matter with you?
Right.
You know, so your kids, your young kids. And it's crazy, but if you look at the way we train people now, it's the same formula.
Yeah.
You know, usually we have armor on, guys don't get hurt. Can't have a doctor get his hands broken, right? So,
right.
And then later on, you have a little more successes towards the end of the, you know, your kids. So there was a lot of, you're very physical. So most of us were pretty athletic. So, there was, you know, you hit bags, hit pads, jumping kicks. It was the 70s. So it was a lot of karate based stuff. A lot of throwing, a lot of locking, you know. But in the very beginning, it was take pain. That's how it was, like take pain. You know what I mean? So you have to learn how to get a hit and take it, because you're not going to be good enough to not get hit. Later on, you won't be hit anymore. No one will touch you with a blade. But by then, it won't matter anymore. But in the next 10 years, you're going to have to, like, do not let the hit affect you. Like, don't flinch. And if you get hit, you know, none of that. You know, like, he used to say, like, even if your head comes off, your head on the ground, your face should still be calm. Like, they should even know you're hit. You know, like,
right.
So that's how you know he saw a lot of stuff. You know what I mean? In real fights, once you see people react to things, you close fast and the fights are over quick, right? So he was, don't let them know. So there was a lot of that training. And that stopped later. By the time we were like 15, that was already done, because we were a little hardened by that already. You know, and there was exercise, you know, conditioning, you know, you hit things. And I remember in high school, I had to get up before the sun came up. And you had to hit the bag with your hands and with the bat and with sticks and pipes, you know, and do some footwork exercise and weights on your legs and that, you know, you keep going until the sun comes up.
Sure.
And I would do stuff like, I would check the time when the sun comes up and I'd try, like, oh man, I'm going to do it for 10, 20 minutes today. You know, sometimes you wake you up because you keep going.
Yeah.
You know, we were doing everything to not train. By the time we were teenagers, it was like that. Because we already saw the effects of being, you know, by the time we're 15 or 10 years in on this kind of training, you know, and I remember other guys in other groups training, and they weren't training like that. You know, they weren't like that. Like, they would not come there. They were like, oh, we're not going over there. Maybe that's crazy. Like, that's, by the time I was 15, man, yeah, it was, we appreciated it by then.
Right.
And it was necessary by then. You know what I mean? Because without that training, we'd be on the corner with all the boys, you know, in neighborhoods like that, you join the gangs to be protected. We didn't have to do that. Now, I wasn't saying we wouldn't hang out in the corners with the boys with 40 ounces. It's, we'd do that, but we weren't with those guys. We weren't doing business with anybody on the block.
Because in our
neighborhood, every block had a gang. 168 had a gang. 169, crazy, man. I'm like, why could you guys get together and run this whole spot, you know? But that's how they were, you know, that's how the environment was, you know?
Right. So, cause like when I can only envision like at the age, cause I got three boys on my own, live very similar to your dad. I got three boys. And so I'm trying to train them, but hearing all of that, it seems that there was an urgency to be tough immediately? Like, how did that affect you, whether for good or for worse? I'm curious, like, how did that affect you in terms of just overcoming normal childhood struggles or teenage struggles? Because at a teenage, 15 years old is a kind of a weird age, because you're young and you're learning about your, you know, there's all these different changes in your body and mentally and emotionally. How did that impact you and possibly fortify you for that age group to say no to the gangs and to say no to those things? Like, how did that go? How did that work in your favor?
I mean, we already knew not to be part of that. You know, we saw guys get shot and stabbed for material stuff. You know what I mean? Mm. It's all about, you know, it's like anything else. These are groups of people who are fighting over money and resources. You know, something you see see countries doing that, right? I just didn't want to be involved with that. You know, so we never got into the blame, the watches. And, because those are the things, if you're not in the gangs, those are the things that got you to violence.
Mm.
You know, I remember I got a leather jacket once because I wanted one so bad, you know, cool leather. And my dad bought it for me and he was like, that's going to be gone before. That's going to be gone before New Year. You know, my birthday's in November, and he was right, man. 9/11 to the face, mass attack fight, took my jacket, you know. So those kind of things, like, even now you don't see a lot of, like, material things with us. We don't believe in the nice houses. Everything's functional, and that's how it, you know. We were not known for you know, when you're young like that, especially with if you're hanging out with a Filipino social scene. And we did a lot because a block from our house was a nicer area, and we hung out with Filipinos and a lot of Asians from that area, and they got into fights, but they were fist fights. On the block, you weren't like that. You're stabbing, and eventually everybody was shooting. So it was better to hang out with these guys. They were tough. You know, when you're raised that way, you hang out with guys who tend to be the same way. They were tough. They hated the racism. These guys would fight on a hat. Bang, they're on it, right? So, but they fist fought, you know, and it was nice because fist fighting, it's nice, you know, like you don't have to worry about anybody dying. It's like sparring. Nobody's going to die. So that's how it affects us socially, you know what I mean? And we made sure that we hung out with these guys so we could stay out of the neighborhood as much as possible. But eventually you'd have to come home. I remember I used to have some friends who were pretty, you know, they had pretty good money. They would never drive me, you know, they're driving Cadillacs or Mercedes. And they would never drop me off at the house. The car would get taken by the corner. You know, they drop me 2 blocks out. I'd make us walk. And they were right. I mean, you know, you didn't want to shoot it out on the block for your car. You know what I mean? That's crazy. You know, and that's how that training did. Now, as far as hardships, nothing was hard that wasn't the block. Like, I was an honor student in high school. It was a way to get away from the block. That stuff was easy. And like, by the time I got to my higher levels in high school, calculus and physics, easy. Because there's no stress. Like, nothing's going to happen to you. If you fail this test, you just take it again or do better on the next one. And like, you're not going to the hospital for seconds. You know what I mean? So that's how that, everything is not living in a neighborhood like that. It's back to basics. If you're, if you make it to certain places alive, you're good.
Check.
So everything else, like all the stress, everything else is not, it pales in comparison, you know?
Right. Yeah. Because the way you described your childhood, both in the firesides and in this interview so far, you know, it's very different than the way most of us as Filipino Americans grew up. I know when I was growing up as a kid, you know, I'm a generation or two under you. This type of tough upbringing was more common in the older generations of Filipino Americans above me. And then, you know, to hear you say, like, well, your perspective is obviously going to be different because of the academic. It's like, it's nothing compared to the physical violence that you're witnessing on a regular basis. And I kind of want to backtrack in regards to the training and the preparation for that violence, because I've heard so many stories about your father. You've spoken about your dad and, you know, his skill and all these things. Growing up, what was it like, being his kid? Like, what was it like seeing him as your dad? I've always wanted to know that, because again, I have 3 boys of my own, and I'm kind of in this position where I'm looking at them, wondering how they're looking at me. And I'm curious, like, was he like as a dad, not just as a martial arts teacher, but as a dad? Like, what was he like? Was it like a typical Filipino dad, or, you know, how was that? Ethan is 7. He's 7 now.
All right. I started when I was 5. Mm-hmm. I look at the kids now, like, you guys, you know, I don't have kids, right? So I look at your guys' kids and I'm like, wow, I don't believe that was happening. Like, 7, I was carrying a blade already. And my dad's like, don't leave home without it. You know, by the time we were 13, putting machetes in the school bags.
Right.
You'd be leaving home without this again. So, I mean, it was normal. First of all, we enjoyed like the blade things. It was something that we were all attracted to anyway. My dad was in the circle that he was in, and we would hear from Pamanato when he was young. He was a legend. You know what I mean? As far as fighting, like never been touched on the street. You know, guys would pull knives on him. He put his knife away, fighting with his hands, fighting a lot of people. Like we heard like a lot of all the things that people say today that are impossible. I don't know what they're talking about.
Right.
Oh, you'll always get stabbed in a knife fight. And I remember I was talking to my dad once, you know, by the time I was 15, 16, pretty arrogant about the skill set. You know, you're not really losing fights, you know, giving people knives, telling you to stab, you know, take this fucking knife, stab, you know, and then you're messing them up. You're doing your thing, right? And he would be like, I would start, I don't know. I'm like the master now. And he goes, you're the master, raise your hands. He would do this. And I've had stab wounds in my hands and he has none. He goes, who's the master? Like, who's the master? You know, I'm like, well, at least they're not on my body. He goes, nothing. He would, like, that's,
that was
like a conversation with my dad, you know? And, I mean, he was most of the time he was a father, you know, loved his kids. I mean, he really wanted to be a dad. Like his father had him, like I think his dad was like late 50s or early 60s when he had him, you know. So he never really knew his dad. So he had his kids young. I think he had a bum when he was 20 or something like that.
Right.
So he was like, no, you have your kids, don't be an old guy, you know, that kind of thing. Different now. There's a lot of people that have kids older now, but as much as he can, he wanted to hang out with his kids. You know, it was the same thing. The struggle to provide was a thing. And until, you know, they started getting higher in their positions and their jobs and the money started coming in. But a lot of love was shown during training. So there would be no hugs. I mean, you know, how's it going? Boom, he'd punch you in the stomach, like, real, you know, or he would sit there, like, I haven't seen him in a while. Like, if I was in, like, college, he'd come, and then he would hit me, and I'd have to block him. All right, the alcohol's not messing with you too much, you know, that kind of thing. So it was always like that. It was always like that. And when we were all together, me and my brothers were all there. And by then we had a bunch of guys who were training with us already, like students we had. It would always end in like someone picks up a blade and there was no training blade. So we just get like, you know, butter knives and kitchen knives. And then he would start going at it. And then it would be a full blown training session. But there was at a later age, it was no longer because he knew that we were already teaching and everybody was doing their own thing. My younger brother, old brother were going around and sparring everybody they can find. You know, so he knew that we were training. But then usually like Christmas, training, Thanksgiving, training. After you eat, everybody sleeps and wakes up, somebody picks up a trainer, a knife, a wooden something, and then they start going and that's it. And so it was like play. It started out as play and then the training kicked in. So
sure.
My brothers might have a different you know, you're probably gonna interview them eventually, might have a different perspective, but that's what I that's what I remember. When I think of like my dad's upbringing, it was always training. It was always all the lessons were through the blade. Lessons through the blade. Hardships in the battle are the hardships. You know, you learn the blade because like in life, once you make a decision, you got to run with that decision. You know what I mean? Like, just like the blade, if you make the wrong decision, you get cut. There's no uncutting yourself. You
know? Right.
You might die or you might make a decision that gets somebody next to you hurt. You know, you would just attach that always to like to life stuff. Because guys who made the most mistakes in life, if they live to an older age, they usually got a lot of wisdom if they learn the protocols, all of it. You know what I mean? So he was really into that kind of training. So and when I teach the same way. I'm always talking about blade to life, right? So it's why we have so many 20-year guys.
Yeah.
It's why, because they're not they're there for the blade, but the blade, they're there for the other thing. You
know? Right.
Stuff that makes life quality of life better. So my dad was in the infancy of that kind of talk. Come on, I told him and took that over completely. Like, man, he knew what he was doing with that stuff.
Check. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, very fast. So it seems to me, from what you're telling me, that your father, his love language was really training. Like, the way he expressed
That's what I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there was no, like, I love you, and everyone's like, kiss you on the head. Like, you know, all the boys are in the sleeping. And
sure.
But there was not... Yeah, there was less of that in like that type of affection. It was affection, like I said, it was more wrestling. Everybody by
sure,
the
yeah.
People are hitting yeah. each other. And, you know, I remember one time I was showing my brother a lock. And I had him on the ground locked up. And I was like, check this out. I got this lock. And I'm doing this lock. I'm holding him. And he's trying to get up. He can't. He goes, you yeah. know how you check if this really works? My dad picks up something. I think it was a machete. And he starts slapping my brother with the flat. If he can't get up from that, then that lock works. Like,
yeah.
And then we all laugh. Everybody goes, you.
Yeah, right, right.
That's how it was, man. That's right. Exactly how. Not different from what we do in the mountain.
Sure, 100%.
Right. People get hurt. Oh, the most violent training you'll ever see, like mm-hmm. the stuff that we do, and everybody goes, hangs out and eats. You know what I mean? A little party afterwards, same thing. And it's kind of like that because it's, you know, as much as we're an organization, I try and run it like a family thing, right? As
100%. Much as
possible. Yeah, there's no tension. Salute me. No, I don't like that. Mm. But there needs to be like an established chain of command, right?
Yes.
That's how things run well. And
yes.
the ranks in the chain of command have to be deserved.
100%.
By skill. Yeah. For me, the teaching delivery, moral fiber, or straight skill set. You know what I mean?
Check.
So yeah. That's how it was in my family.
Same. Interesting.
Same exact way. Yeah.
Right. So fast forwarding now from your childhood into maybe like teenage, college years. You know, obviously your training years, you're mentioning, and you mentioned this in the Firesides on YouTube as well, the training becomes more practical. It's more necessary. You're seeing a lot of these things go yeah. violent things. And I don't want to ruin it for everybody. So anyone listening to this, watching this, go check out the YouTube Firesides, Atienza Fireside. They cover this in pretty good detail. Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. By all means.
We, I'll answer the questions. Like we edited a lot of that stuff out. So there was a lot of, every time you saw a transition, you're like, man, we,
yeah, yeah.
That's crazy. So. I'll try and talk about it.
But, sure.
So teen years. So by our teen years, people kind of knew us already in the area. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the kids would come in to learn how to do things, to fight, you know, because they like that house never got robbed. Like on our block, we have 10, 12 houses, every house in 10 years robbed 3-4 times. Never our house. You know, I mean, we didn't have anything, you know, there's nothing to take and those guys would chop you up. So like mm-hmm. even the crackheads were like, nah, that's not worth crack right there. You know, so didn't wait for guys in the house, man. It was kind of, you know, like when you're that young, it's like the dream. So like, cause everything is good, everything is legal, you know what I mean? Mm. Like once they're in the house. And I remember not having alarms on the windows or not like fortified. You know what I mean? It's kind of like a trap. We had dogs, always had dogs, because dogs always wake up.
Right.
The only way you disarm a dog, you have to kill them, right? So and if they're killing your dog, they're in the house. So
right.
We were known for that, you know, like when there was block parties and guys are playing the radios and, you know, trunks are open, everybody's blasting music, we would hang out and listen. You know, everybody, it's the block, we've been there for a while, right. and they knew, man, we had the shitty sticking out the ground, and they knew who we were, you know?
Right.
They're not the stick guys, you know, they're the pipe and the shitty guys, you know.
Right.
So and we never had to join a gang. We never had the politic drama of, oh, I would join and then they made me do something I don't want to do anymore. They're after me. And then, you know, we didn't have that. You know what I mean? So, so guys started to come to hang out with us to train. And that's how we started teaching. It wasn't because we wanted to teach. So there was guys on the block that wanted to train. And, you know, I remember we weren't charging at all. And I was like, look, we'll train you. We'll do a tribal. You know, like you hear a lot about like how the old elders would never charge for like to teach their skill sets. That comes from the tribal times where I'm going to teach you. But when it's time to throw down, you better stand right next to me, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like thing. The payment is you don't run, you know, when we have to throw down. So that's how the teaching started. So everything had to be real because these guys are probably going to get, something was going to happen to them within the next 7 to 14 days of training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, hey, I got stabbed. We looked at the shirt. How do I, all right. Right-handed guy. Yeah. Was it this kind of this way? Yeah. Oh no. He was holding, he had you pinned up. How do you know? All right, against the car, were you leaned up on the hood? Were you on the glass? Mm-hmm. Were you on a wall? You know, like then you start going through all the scenarios like this, how you do this, how you free yourself, straighten up this, you know, and you start going through all of the different scenarios and how they can get clear of things like that. So next time you see him, it's like, oh, I got this guy tried to do it against me, but he didn't catch me here. Now he caught me here on the arm.
Right.
Like, good, it's getting farther away from your vitals, you're doing better, you
right.
know, that kind of thing. And, most of those guys didn't hang around because eventually they were kids. So eventually the parents left the neighborhood. Once the finances were good, they were gone.
Right.
So, but there was a few of them. And if they didn't train, they'd be dead. Mm-hmm. It definitely would be dead, you know. So, and it was a neighborhood where everybody carried a knife.
Mm.
Yeah, everybody, didn't matter who you were, everybody carried a knife. Everybody carried the big knives, small knives. Everybody carried it. Everybody carried a blade. I remember watching knife fights in my locker room in high school just to see how they did. Oh, these guys know what they're doing. All right. That's how it's more anger and attitude and aggression than skill, you know what I mean?
Right.
And we got to catalog all of that, you know.
Sure.
So yeah, that's how the teaching started. So it wasn't like a curriculum. It was like, all right, you're going to be stabbed in this much time. This is how you not get stabbed. All right, do you want to stab him back? Do you want to hit him with a tropical? Do you want to hit him with a pipe? Or do you want to use your hands?
Right.
Well, you want to use your hands, you're 125 pounds. You don't hit a bag, you don't hit mitts. So it has to be realistic, man. Put this hammer in your belt. And when they do this, just hammer them out. You know what I mean? Put this pipe on, you know, and this is how you get through this.
Right.
And, you know, we got good at doing that.
Yeah.
No one under our tutelage ever hit the ground. You know, they ever, you know, even if they were jumped by a bunch of dudes.
Sure.
They might have got tired.
Right.
You know, back then everybody was 70s, 80s.
Oh, yeah. Smoking.
Okay. A lot of guys, like, you train and then, you know, the fight rate, man, the heart rate goes up right away. You're cold, right. You know, and most of the time they would even out with their opponent because they were tired because they smoked too much or they're drinking too much.
Right.
That kind of thing. Yeah. And fear makes everything, like, makes you more tired. You
know? 100%. Yeah.
So that's kind of like the, so that's how the teaching started.
Check. And yeah, because I remember, I'm sorry. In the teens. Oh yeah. Yeah. So, cause I remember when I met you, I saw you at going back when you had your first public session at Across the Floor, a dance studio in Woodbridge. I was a junior in high school, and I remember seeing you and Tuan D and Tuan Bong were there. And some other people that are no longer in the system were there, but I remember watching you move and I could really tell, like, this is the guy I'm going to train under. Like, this guy is this is the teacher right here. And I remember getting back in the car with my dad. And he asked me, he's like, who would you train with? And I said, Atien Zakali. And he goes, like Edgar, like Butch Atienza. And I said, yeah. And he's like, okay, I keep training with those guys, you know, like, keep training with those guys. So I don't think my dad and your father, because again, my father was in Queens. I was born in Queens. I don't think he ever but he's seen your father. He saw your father perform demos. So your father had this reputation. Now seeing you at that point of 2001, 2002 going public, I was always curious, because this is one thing I wanted to ask you when I saw you at that time. It's like, well, this is your full-time thing, because Filipino martial arts is not a full-time job for a lot of people. Making that transition from corporate America, where I know a lot of Filipino Americans are even now, or medical, and then going into teaching Filipino martial arts full-time. I mean, that must have been such a risk, if you will. What was that like, making that transition from corporate America to pursuing your passion, pursuing your dream, like pursuing you're doing now?
I mean, it was pretty stable in corporate America, man. It's decent money, I guess, at that time. I was like 75,000, 80,000 a year, something like that, in 2003. But man, I just didn't like. It's like Christmases were coming faster every year. And
shit,
you know, like,
yeah,
help is not good.
Mm.
Like, you're coming home late. There's no work. And I don't want to get home and go for a 4 mile run. That's not happening. Man.
Right.
Some Chinese food, go to sleep. Worse. And get up in the morning, do the same thing again.
Sure.
And I'm a good worker. I'm not the guy any during the weekend. Okay. I hear everybody complaining, and I hate that complaining stuff. Right. And, I mean, I hate it when I do it. I did. When it's like, well, man, you get paid. Yeah, we work half the day, man. We're getting like 80 grand a year. What are you complaining about? You know,
right?
Easy work. And I was working in the bank. I was a server guy doing a lot of tech work, right? And I mean, it wasn't a risk. Monotone was like, you can do it.
Mm.
Like, this is not before. This is not the 80s and 70s where it couldn't be done. It could be done now.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It could be done now. And after 9/11, 2001. It was a lot easier to do because a lot of people were trying to get ready. You know, they saw some crazy thing happen and they were trying to get ready and whatever that meant to them. And that's how the students started coming in. And a lot of the old first students, corporate America, were guys who were former street guys who are not those guys anymore. And they were in gangs when they were younger. They saw some real stuff and they looked at the way we trained. They're like, all right. Yeah, that would work. You know what I mean? Like, you see Marshall Klein, I just grabbed the goal. I remember my dad used to do a test with a lot of guys, like a lot of guys doing drills and stuff, and they're saying they were good because they were doing a lot of drills. And he would like, he would just put a one punching glove on. It was real weird, right?
Yeah.
And then he would just grab him by the collar and stop tagging him in the face. Mm. So where's those drills now? What's somebody that they, you know,
right.
Whipping him around, keep him off balance, you know? And he's like, you don't have to sweep them, just run backwards. And they fall down, you just keep punching him in the face. Like, where's the drills now? Where are those drills now? You know? Or you guys would be like, oh, I'm good at these blocks, and using the little ass, like, the little, like, those light ass sticks.
You hit
people in the head and then they break and stuff.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, he would pick up a stick and then he would slop it as he's going to put a baseball bat in his hand. He would see it and he'd bang the hole. And they would try and block him and they would crush him. You're like, that's what sticks look like on the street.
Right.
Like, you fight with those sticks. There's guys on the street, their heads are so hard, they only feel that.
Right.
So I got a story about that. We'll talk about it later. How I learned about power stunts.
That might be a whole podcast by itself.
I would start using pipes and not sticks on the street.
Right. Yeah. I definitely want to get into that.
Actually,
yeah.
What was the question?
I don't know. Oh, no, it's just like making that leap from the corporate world. To starting your own business and, you know, all the risks that come with that. And you mentioned just now, Juan Monotone said, you can do it. But I'm sure there was some kind of like, well, like, can I really do it? Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah.
Yeah, Pamana told him, he said that we can do it. And I'm one of those guys, man. And this comes from being in the neighborhood. Like, you go out, you know, like Halloween in the 80s, always, like, you're always training for Halloween, right? So that's machete time, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you had guns, that's gun time right there. There's 300 boys are going to hit the street and then they're going to go wilding out, and the cops ain't going to do anything about it. You know,
so
we would always train for Halloween. And as it got closer to the late 80s, it got worse and worse and worse, right? And it would be an option to go to school. So then my dad would go, it's Halloween. And if it fell on a weekday, it's like, you guys going to school today? And I would go, and he was like, oh shit, like, you know, like, because it was not a mile to the school, and you could get into a whole bunch of stuff on the way there. Like, up the corner from a block when I was a kid, some kid tried to hit me with a screwdriver for gang initiation, and that's where I learned how to strip blades. That's where I learned that they work well. It was screwdriver, there's no edge. And that's how you could tell, like, the fear in another person's eyes. Like, a stab is not, you know, most guys don't know what a stab, they're not trained, so they stab crazy. And a lot of things can happen on the way to that ride, on the way to that walk to the school. And I remember during those days where you knew something might happen, it would be the same thing, all right? Put your blade on and walk out that door. So when it was time to go from corporate America to this life, I put the blade on and walk out that door.
Roger. Yeah. So Roger,
if
that
you have skill, you'll be successful. That's what it was. It's always those little metaphors that do it, those little energetic metaphors that, you know, you've been running this, you've been putting a blade on since you were 5 years, about 7 years old.
Right.
All right. Put it on. I still tell the guys now, all right, put the blade on, walk out the door.
Roger that. Yeah. That's
your
awesome.
Your skill should manage that life out past that door.
Check.
So you just go. You just do it. And if you mess up, you mess up. I mean, it wasn't really that bad. I mean,
right.
You would know in the first 6 months, a year, if you would be successful at it. And you just get a job. There's no big deal.
Yeah.
Go back to the slave ship and crank out some money. You know. By the time, you know, I was 29, 30 years old. So, you know, by 38, get us some blood pressure meds, get some Lipitor, like 40.
I think that's about the time I met you. Were you in your 30s when I met you?
Yeah.
I think, you're in your 30s. I'm 38 now. So it's like, thinking of that time frame, it's like I'm at the age you were when you went public. So, yeah.
Man, we went public at 30 years old. I was 30 when we went public. I remember that. Because Pamana Tuan brought us to this, he brought us to this place where we sparred guys every weekend for 8 weeks.
Remember, media, yeah.
Yeah, man, it was awesome. We had to use these padded sticks. So that no one was padded sticks back then. We were eating dull machines and heavy sticks back then. So when we sparred each other, we didn't, but we fought people outside. We didn't want anyone talking about who won. You knew who won because that guy stopped fighting. You know, so, but he was like, you can't market that.
Right.
You can't make money from that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you got all that stuff, you're going to have to do with this toy.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. Yeah. Pretty cool.
Like, I was part of that generation. I was at the media session, but I remember going to 2-1-D's class and hearing these stories about, oh, we got to go to Pennsylvania this week. You know, just, we won't have class this week. We have, I was like, where are they going? You know? So
it's cool. Yeah. No, it was cool. And we were young and we were, it's corporate America, right? There's no more street stuff. Like,
right.
You know, you'd have to go every once in a while to gas, get, fight some trains, and that happens in New York all the time. There was a lot of sparring at that point, you know, because sparring is like the thing you do when you're relaxing.
Yeah.
Like when we'd spar in Jamaica, when we were in Queens, it was like, oh, your friends are sparring and no one's going to get hurt. But man, you could see it's like when guys are doing the pressure testing, right? They go from sparring to pressure testing. They're like, wow, you can see their heart drop. They start. So when you're sparring, everybody's all frolicky and happy.
Right.
It was the same guys would spar, but then they'd have to go walk home.
Right.
From the house. There you go. And then they see them putting the blades in and you can see them getting worried. You know, because it's not going to be one guy. I mean,
of course.
Jump on, right. So, because they know the guys coming out of that block, at that house, you're not going to, it's not going to be an easy fight, you know. So if they had a gun, they shoot at you. You know, back then, the guns weren't as, they were like those little 25s and 22s.
Right.
Not like now, everybody's got red dot Glocks and stuff.
Yeah.
And all the kids, it's a different day these days, you know. So like you said, the corporate America thing, it was, I had back falls, so put some money away and then, but I could probably always go back to corporate America at that time and still,
Roger.
You know, I was in corporate, I was doing that work for like 6 years. I had friends who were still there. I'm like, hey, I'm going to do this thing. What's up? You know, if I mess up, I'm going to call you in a year, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't that much of a thing. It was more like, I want this lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So no plan B, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. And what is it definitely worked out. I'm still here. I started 2002 and I'm still here talking to you, still training with you. So it definitely worked out. And just seeing the growth is, especially from this past Call the Mountain, the 20-year anniversary was so eye-opening and so surreal to see, especially seeing all those old faces from back in the day. And speaking of people from back in the day, someone who's still with you now, Selak Dayan, your wife, I don't know how you guys met, like in the story of all this craziness and your upbringing and stuff like that. And this woman, and she's been with you since I've known you, like even before that. So I'm curious, like what was your story? Like, how did you meet? And, you know, she's on this journey with you. She works alongside you in the tribe and the system you have a business together. So can you talk about a little bit of that, how you guys met and how like the training impacted your relationship and how it's, you know, keeping you guys going strong. Now, how long have you been married now?
So 23.
Wow.
Married. I don't really count the marriage. I count when we met.
So
we met in 95.
Yeah.
So I was 23 at the time. I'm 51. So whatever that math is.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, part of the success of anything like this, this is out of the norm, right? You have to have a woman that's down for the ride.
Mm.
She's got to be 100% ride or die. She has to be. She has to be, because now, luckily, we make money. So it's not like we're poor doing this.
No. Right.
We make money. Like, she sees it. All right. But they got to be down for it. Because, first of all, without the energy of the female energy for guys like us, man, a lot of us probably would probably be in jail.
So,
I mean, realistically, because we stay calm and we stay wise and we stay, we try not to answer crazy things that happen on the street these days, because a lot of people get affected,
right?
You know, so we and then having a female energy kind of neutralizes that hard male energy, especially us men. Pretty rough when we were young, like we were almost like animals, you know what I mean?
Right.
So we met, there was a lot of alcohol in like early 20s. Yeah, I was like a professional drinker. We don't do that anymore.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I'm an alcoholic, but I don't drink, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And pretty much I look back, I was straight alcoholic, right? You know, you're trying to shut off the voices. You know, when you're young and you see certain things, especially violent things, you're too immature to process that. I mean, there's guys now who are full soldiers that have a hard time processing violence. So it may not even be an age thing. And then you have friends who probably were there with you and, or they've seen the same thing, you know, like my younger brother one time was walking down the street. It wasn't even a fight that he was in. And kids would throw like bottles off the roof, and he saw some guy's brains pour out on the sidewalk.
Mm.
You know, he's 12 years old. You know, by 13, you're smoking cigarettes. By 14, you're drinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and training reversed all of that. And you can see it in our crew, right? You know, see, right. There's no bottles of liquor never come out in our training sessions, man. It's not a rule, but it doesn't happen.
Right.
And, you know, it's a weakness I can't afford these days, especially who I am and what I do, right? And I was drunk at a party, and, you know, and we used to hold parties in the medical office. So after a while, we tried not to go to other, like, outside parties. We just hold our own parties. So if you got into a fight there, we're just your friends. You
know,
no one's getting stabbed or shot. Every once in a while, we'd go out. You know, we're just socializing. We were into that thing back in the day. And, you know, you had friends who were DJs and, you know, all these different crews would all meet up. And then every once in a while, there'd be someone said something about somebody. Somebody talked to somebody's girl. Or, you know, if you're on the street, somebody's messing with someone's money.
Mm-hmm.
And we were drunk one day, and I met her there.
Mm.
Yeah. And we hooked it pretty fast, too. It was, you know, it was part of the formula for what I'm doing now.
Right.
To have somebody like that. Because she's not like, she's not violent. She didn't see the stuff I saw. She did eventually, you know, but like growing up, she didn't see that. So,
right.
You know, she was, she's like the calm person. Like, she doesn't have the trauma. And it's important for someone like me to know someone who's like that. Because you have two people see the trauma, you just got a bunch of guys who are violent and rough. Sure. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, she's been that supportive person since then. Like, in the relationship, I'm the one who complains.
Mm.
She's the calm one. Mm. I'm the one who's like, oh, this has got to be issues. She was like, just take care of that shit. It's mad with me. You know?
It sounds like me and my wife.
Yeah. Guys like us, like, we're always, things that I've seen, you always think some things are going to happen. I'm better at that now.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of post-traumatic stress in our heads, you know, and it's nice to be with someone who doesn't have that.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, it's very important to make sure that's done. I get students who join Santa Cali, and I'm like, I'll look at them, and you just know how they are with their wives, and you'll know, man, I put a clock to when they're going to be gone.
Right. You know? Check.
That's especially when they have their first baby's born. You know,
right.
We have that protocol, right? You guys have been with us like 10 years, first baby's born. I was like, all right. So look, you got 5 years, man.
Mm-hmm.
5 years to be back. I says, what if I don't make 5 years? Look, you always can be back. But it's not me who's not, you're not coming back because I'm telling you not to. You're not coming back because someone else is telling you not to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool. You just got to know that's how it is.
Right.
So, yeah, I see it all the time. Like, most of the guys now, people are fairly successful now. Money is really not an issue with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff you see now is because of what happens, not on the street, in the house.
Right.
Like, inside the walls of the house is where the biggest battles are going on right now. So,
right.
You tend to see that. You know, like, everybody plans on how they fight somebody.
Mm-hmm.
People, like, I can plan with you. All right, we're going to go to this place. There's dudes out there. You're going to go out there. This is what you're going to do. You're going to be this guy. You have these weapons. You projectile, blah, blah, blah. We could talk about how we're going to get ready for any type of violence. But nobody ever sat down with their wives and talked about how they were going to raise their kids before they had kids.
Yeah.
They realized that they're in the fight and nobody's doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So, check. And that's where a lot of that craziness comes from. Like, you wanted me to be rich? I didn't want to be rich, you know, rich guy. I'm like, I never wanted to be rich. And then shit like that happens. So
right.
It sucks, but it's all standard relationship stuff.
Right.
So, that's why, like, as much as possible, the person who runs something like a Tian Zakali, that the house has to be as stable as possible.
Right.
And then the organization stays as stable as possible.
Roger that. Yeah, 100%.
So I learned, and that's from Pamana too.
Check.
That's from Sayok LOT. Like, you know, you can always tell how they're going to be with their students and how they're going to be with their wives, you know. So that's
how. And I really wanted to get into, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No,
you're good.
No, I was wondering, like, because before we end this podcast, I really definitely want to go into, you know, Pamana Tuhon. And because when I think of Filipino American leadership, I think of you and Pamana Tuhon, like, off the top of my head, like, the way you guys have been able to run these organizations, basically do something that everyone said was impossible, and then create these massive organizations that are influencing people all over the world in a positive way. And so I kind of want to go into that and talk about Jesse Pamatuhan, and his lessons in leadership. Because most of us as Filipino American men, we were not raised to be leaders. A lot of us would react emotionally, or we don't know what it's like to necessarily take charge of families or organizations. So, speaking of leadership, could you go into your relationship with Pamatuhan and the lessons of leadership that you learned from him, following his example, into your own organization?
So one of the first things that my father was part of an organization, Artists Americas, in '70s. So he ran that for a little while. Pamatuhan was there. A lot of grandmasters were there.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool. I think that's that organization brought in like some of the Dos Pares guys and Professor B, Matt Marinas, Leo Gahe.
Right.
I think Mary Presas. It was some beef. You know, Filipino some beef with each other. It's something that we had to learn to stop doing. You know,
right.
Like no more beefs, no more like the system split bullshit. You know, like so. That's what Tuan taught us. I'm not saying one day it wouldn't happen, but under my watch, it's probably not going to happen, right? So no splits, no. First time I knew Tuan, I was young. When I first started training, my dad brought me over to a Taekwondo school, and I went over there to train. Him and my father and his father, Da Dong Bo, they were friends, and then Pamatuhan was like, he's a teenager at the time, right?
Right.
But I was like five, I think he was 9 years older than me. So I was 14 at the time, or something, 15, 16. I would do demos. And I hated it, man. I hated demos. I would sit there 5 years old and do wrist lock, like kicking fun. I hated it every time we would do the big Filipino festivals.
Yeah.
You know, like the Polvoron contests and you know, like, try and whistle the Filipino national anthem.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, like all that.
Yeah.
And
and
during these festivals, they would do like a martial arts demo, and I would be the young guy doing the demos, and I hated it, man. I would hide, and he would find me and get up there.
Yeah.
Little did he know, like he did that anyway, right?
Yeah.
He threw me up there anyway, and I'd do that for a living. So I was, by the time I was 15, I could teach in front of people like no problem, you know, because of that, you know. And then a bunch of gang guys were trying to kill me in my early teens, and he had helped me with that. And, then, and every time, you know, this is on the job training, right? So
yeah,
all the mindset training is done there. You know, like we can get into that later. I'm not sure if I want to talk about that.
No, yeah, no worries. That's another interview.
I mean, all these guys are still around. Like they might see this interview. So, but you know, so it was over a girl. Same thing. These guys trying to, I'm going to go to your school and kill you. Brought nine guys at school and then he helped it out. We managed to keep the violence, you know, low. And, but the training, mindset training, you get, you know what I mean? Like, you know, my dad taught it, but now my Tuan is teaching me while it's happening.
Right.
And it's different. Like my dad is not the same person when he's with Pamatuhan. He's not my dad anymore. Like the way they're talking, the way they're looking, I'm like their student. I remember I had a big knife, like a big 13-inch knife, because that was our standard, right? And you fight a lot of guys. I remember I was supposed to go out and talk to these boys on the corner because I was looking for somebody, right? And before I went out, he swapped out the blade for like this little axe handle I made. Can I get my blade back? He goes, nope, you're gonna have to do it with that. I'm like,
right.
Yeah. And he was always doing stuff like that. He goes,
sure.
And I remember telling him, later when I saw him when I was my 30s, I was like, hey, remember when you swapped out that thing, that blade for that stick? He goes, yeah. I said, so you knew nothing was going to happen and I was going to be fine. And I was like, no, man, you could have got killed that day. But that's what it was.
You know? Right. Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. And I get it now because I do stuff like that now, right?
So, yeah.
Some of the training is pretty dangerous, right?
Right.
And, that it was that kind of training. Then, you know, we worked with him a little bit in our teams. He used to do construction, so we would demo houses and rebuild them in the hood, like South Jamaica. So that was pretty cool. Like we'd have to go, and you know, if you left all the stuff in there, all the crackheads come in and try to steal the copper piping. So we, you know, pass out a bunch of blades and we clear the house.
Yeah,
the house clears. Like, how did your dad teach you how to clear houses? Like, let's go. And the crackheads fly out the windows in the back. Go inside. There's rubbers everywhere. Like, you have to clean all that to roll it up in the carpet, throw it out.
Yeah,
you know, so. It was cool training, but he knew that we were a certain way with blades already. So when he trained us, it was like when he actually trained us, it was no weapons; it was all left hands. Because he knew, like, man, we're not using our hands. Like these guys on the street, like we have the advantage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how big the guy is.
Yeah, right.
300 pounds, we got weapons, and there's no advantage. We have the advantage.
So right.
It takes advantage away. You know, he's, and you'll talk to a lot, but if you talk to any other guys, like the other Tuans in SAG, it was all about getting you out of the comfort zone. I just wish he didn't do it on the job. Like,
yeah, right.
You know, like he'd flog me or burn me or something while we're training, but not like, oh, man, we have to fight these guys. Like at any time, you know, when guns come out and start popping, like the whole, everything changes. You know
yes.
I mean? Like if you don't find that guy, usually mm-hmm. we have a thing, you find the guy with a gun and then go for that guy first. I mean, now everybody's got guns, but like a lot of things can go wrong at that time when I was young. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I wasn't really good at that, doing that kind of thing. And not as good as they were.
Right.
So they were known for, they didn't tell me this. Tuan and my dad didn't tell me this. So it didn't come from them.
Mm-hmm.
But they were known for, like, when the dealers started hitting the neighborhoods, they were known for clearing those blocks out.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing.
Right. You know
I mean, so, yeah, they were known for doing that. They had pretty good protocols on how to, and there would be no guns.
Right.
And it would just be, like, two or three guys, no matter how many guys were over there.
Mm-hmm.
It would just be two or three guys, four max. And they would clear that block, and nobody would come back to that block because they knew there was guys who were going to come after them that were not cops.
Mm.
You know, so when we went to media, Pennsylvania, and we're doing that, Tuan knew my dad trained us for that.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be me and maybe nine of my students, you know, me, Bong, and Dee, and you know, like 10 of us, and he put us against 20 guys, 30 guys, and we would get clear, man. It was cool. Like he knew who we were. Like he was watching us the whole time, so it was kind of cool. But his training was like that mindset training through the martial art.
Heck.
The mindset training you gain in this martial art will be the mindset you have in life.
Roger that. Yeah. And I know that growing up, you've given me that like my whole life. Like anytime that I the world's burning down or there's something going on in my life, I can always go to you, and you'd always bring it back to the metaphor of training, the blade. And it was something that I've not seen in any other martial art. Frankly, this is one, probably the only system next to Sayok that I've seen where, and I know it derives from Sayok, but it is this idea that the blade helps you overcome your battles in life, which most people don't even know how to connect life to the training. And I think that's what you do very well. So
I appreciate that. I'm working on that. You know, that's when I can no longer move a blade.
Mm.
I'm trying to push that as far as possible. Right?
Yeah.
I'll be like to uncoach people with words later in life.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, like during COVID, right? Like we started this battle, right? We got to end it.
Mm-hmm.
And all night, well, it was the same thing we do when we know we're going to go do something crazy, violent.
Roger that, yeah.
You know, you got a real enemy and you got a lot of people thinking different mm-hmm. things about it.
Yeah.
It's like in a regular organization.
Right.
There's an enemy, they all think different things.
Yep.
So there's the main goal, no one dies.
Check.
Second goal is no one gets permanently injured.
100%.
Same thing in battle. Make sure they're dead. If they do get hit,
yeah.
Make sure they're like they're not paralyzed for the rest of their lives. Just like
right.
And we did well.
Roger that.
Well, nobody died, and nobody. Mm-hmm. Died. No one has anything wrong. Anyone directly under our thing, right?
So right.
I had family members who passed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm saying inside our training tribe, our circle, you know, we did pretty good at that, even though there was a lot of like differences in belief systems.
100%.
But I see it just like that. Always like that. Like a bunch of monsters coming after you. You got to fight them. Everybody's all, you know, and let's go, man. Let's do it. Like I said,
let's do it.
Walk out the door. Yeah.
100%. You know, and like when, so before we end, because there's so much I want to ask you, and we're definitely going to bring you back on here for at least two or three other episodes. But and of course, Tuan Bong and Tuan Dee, who I definitely want to have on. Before we end today, I wanted to ask you a question. And so really, this podcast is really for my three sons. It's for Ethan, Evan, and Elliot, right? And I want them to be able to look at this and see this interview and, you know, these Pinoys that impacted our dad, like this is what they taught him. So if, you know, my kids are here, and you have to give them any piece of advice as to being a better man, a better leader, what would you give them?
Man, I'm 51 now, and I guess it'll be different when I'm 71, right? But one of the first things guaranteed in life is you're going to die.
Mm.
That's sure. Mm-hmm. Money, losing money, relationships, addictions, like those are all maybes, what, but you're definitely going to go, right? That's one of the first things, right? You will check out of here. The second thing is there will be battles. They're not, you're not going to be clean.
Check.
what we're talking about are those battles. What we're training for are those battles, not the battles with the blade. Let me tell you, the blade battles are the easiest battles, man. I mean, people trying to get you, trying to attack you, that it's the other ones that are like in the head, you know what I mean? So we are preparing for that. Now, my father succumbed to battles, right? So he didn't clear his battles. So, you know, the stress came in, the food got bad, and eventually he went from hard stuff, right? Enemy inside gets you, right? It's not the blade that gets you, it's the inside blade that gets you, right? So what we're trying to do is train for those battles. All right, so the advice is train. And you'll clear the battles. And you're going to try and clear with very little stabs in the hand, not in the body. You
know what I mean? Right.
And you have to have a crew with you.
Because
no matter how good you are with the blade by yourself, there's a bunch of guys who are half as good as you. But when they all get together, they're going to fuck you up. So make sure you have a crew.
Roger that.
And everybody's down for the same mission.
Now,
all of those things I just said, some of the hardest things to do.
100%.
Some of the hardest things to do.
100%. Well, Tuan Carl, thank you so much. I really respect your time. Thank you so much for taking this time to speak to me and all of us and my boys about, you know, leadership and warrior culture and all these things. Can you tell the audience how to best find you, how to best reach you? Definitely about your, we may talk about your live blades in a future episode, because I know that deserves like a whole hour by itself. How can people reach you and get to know you better?
Chance of College
at Gmail.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I mean, most of the people who join are word of mouth. That's how we like it, right?
How we like it. Roger that.
But that's how we do that.
Sure. So, Instagram? You want to give your Instagram?
Yeah, maybe. Tens of Kali on Instagram, and Tens of Kali on Facebook. We have a Tens of Bladecraft now, which is we just show a little bit more content on blade making, and you know, we're 2024. We're trying to come out a little bit more. We're 20 years now. We got an army of instructors now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We got some 20 pretty hard level hardcore guys, like good, you know. So you know, they're good with the blade, but they get good the transfer, right? The teaching.
Yeah. The delivery.
Master the transfer. Yeah, the delivery. You think you're good with the blade, transfer it to somebody else. Makes you really better, right? So
Roger.
You'll find us.
All right. Tuan Carl, thank you so much. And guys, please follow him on Instagram at Atienza Kali, as well as Facebook at Atienza Kali as well.
So that concludes the interview with Tuan Carl Atienza of Atienza Kali. I hope you enjoyed it and took many lessons from it. Keep an eye and ear out for more podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Pinoy Patriarch Project. And make sure to leave us a rating and review on Spotify and iTunes. Thanks, and I'll see you all next time.